On the Upper Peninsula, there was some bad news for Berrigo County, Michigan, this past week. The Terex Handlers Company will close its Berrigo plant. 90 people will lose their jobs. Berrigo County, about an hour and a half drive west from Marquette, already has a 24.5% unemployment rate. It's the highest in the state of Michigan and the third highest in the country.
Village office?
No, she's gone for the afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, bye.
Roy Kempinen administers Berrigo Village, a town of 1,300. He's been a village manager in this area for 25 years. Kempinen told us that Berrigo's over 100 years old.
It started out a lot with the logging industry, trapping, that kind of situation. That was basically the way it started out.
You will see some more great scenery and our Ojibwa Casino Resort in Berrigo. It's the first operational Native American casino in Michigan. Don't wait for the fun.
This casino is the county's largest employer. Kempinen is grateful for its presence.
Actually, the village Berrigo's had real good relationship with a local tribe. So I'd say it's been a real plus. They do have casino operations as well as other enterprises that they do a major employment in the county.
So there are people that can go work for the casinos?
Absolutely.
Can that also have a negative effect? I mean, people with little money gambling away what they have?
I guess that is a common thing as far as people, spending funds they don't have available for that recreation, and hopefully it won't become a problem, but I guess that's a problem whether or not you're working or not.
How many jobs would you estimate that the casino provides for people in the Berrigo area?
I think that tribal employment is upwards of 700 people, I think, in the county.
How long have you lived here?
I actually grew up about 3 miles from here, so I've been here my entire life, and I'm into my 50s, put it that way.
Huh. You've never had any desire to leave and go someplace else?
No, not really. Not really. I guess I'm just a country boy at heart, I guess.
What do you think are the future prospects for Berrigo?
Well, I think we are well-positioned. We have a lot of skilled labor here as far as fabrication, those kind of situations. I think the work ethic is really good. You know, if the economy does start turning around, I believe they'll be able to go forward.
And it must be tough knowing that you have the highest unemployment in the state and the third highest unemployment in the country.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's certainly not something you want to be known for. I guess the only thing I would say is those people are interested in work and certainly are more than capable of doing it, and I hope that they have that opportunity again shortly.
And what would it take? Government help?
You know, it's a situation. I think if the building industry or home building and stuff like that starts to rebound, I think we'll probably see a upturn in the employment in the area because the orders will be coming in for these pieces of machinery. Like I said, signs are that things might be turning around on that situation a little bit. It just seems to take a while to trickle down.
You do seem optimistic, though.
Well, you have to be. When you've been a manager for this many years, you have to have a positive attitude or you got to get out of it, I guess.
Roy Kempinen is the village manager of the village of Berrigo on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
$307 billion. That's how much Americans gave to charity last year. This year's number is expected to be smaller, and 2010 isn't looking so great for nonprofits either. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The downtown YWCA is a safe haven for women and their children. They can make meals, sit at a comfy kitchen table, and talk about regular stuff, like Halloween costumes. Scary isn't the word the YWCA's chief executive uses to describe her budget crunch, but Sue Sherbrook comes close to it.
We're concerned about how we're going to end the year. We have $633,000 to raise, and there are women and families in our two counties are really depending on us to do it, and we're worried.
And the YWCA isn't alone. Overall, charitable giving fell roughly 6% last year after adjusting for inflation. That's the steepest drop in decades, and this year giving will likely be down again. So far, there have been just two marquee gifts of $100 million or more. Last year, there were 20. Donations by the rest of us are also down. Some people who used to give at the office no longer have jobs. Others, like Carol Pinky, saw their retirement funds take a hit, and they scaled back.
I have regular charities I support. They always try to add something new every year, and last year I just didn't.
In fact, Pinky actually cut the number of charities she supported and gave her money only to those who had earned her loyalty and trust. That response has been fairly typical, suggests Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She says now more than ever, organizations have to court their contributors and show them how the money will be spent.
One of the things charities are trying to do is make it more concrete. They might say, if you spend $25, you can buy 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half hour of a scientist's time, instead of just saying, it'd be nice to cure cancer.
Or feed the hungry, or provide job training. Donors also want to see tangible results from the groups they're supporting. Increasingly, charitable organizations are using tools such as Facebook and Twitter to convey their messages and solicit funds, but most requests for money are still done the old-fashioned way. Asking for money has never been easy, and right now, many charities are nervous about offending people by making a request.
There's a lot of fear out there. There has been for a year.
But Leanne Moss, executive director of the Women's Funding Alliance, knows the only way she could meet the needs of women and girls was to ask for money, sometimes boldly.
It's about being focused on that mission. And I've been in situations in the past where, yes, I have made too large of an ask and had to do a little repair. But in the end, people have respected me and us more for doing that.
Looking ahead to an improving economy, experts believe that individual donations will pick up first, foundation dollars will follow. Overall, says Stacey Palmer of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the outlook isn't very pretty.
It's going to be very, very hard for groups to be able to raise money. They'll be in a squeeze. So I think it's going to be quite a long time till most nonprofit groups can come out of this.
How long will it take? History suggests 2 or 3 years before charitable giving returns to pre-recession levels. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Downtown Marquette, Michigan stands in stark contrast to Berrega. Marquette is thriving. Washington Street comes to life when the sun rises over Lake Superior. This is what downtowns are supposed to look like. Small independent businesses selling everything from bingo supplies to wedding dresses. They're not open yet. But Baby Cakes Muffin Company is already crowded with locals and some tourists. The outdoor tables are taken, so are many inside the small storefront. Charlie Halsworth is behind the counter to take my order.
This is iced vanilla latte.
Iced vanilla latte, black coffee, and 2 blueberry muffins.
By now, a table outside has opened up, and we linger over breakfast. And don't expect to hear hubbub and music from a block away. We go around the corner to investigate and run smack dab into the Saturday morning farmers market. It's in the community square, where members of the Copeman Band are tuning up. The band serenades both consumers and purveyors of what is a plentiful harvest of fruits and vegetables. Tented tables offer a cornucopia of homemade fudge, cheese, meats, and breads.
Okay, I got some eggs. Go hurry up.
We snake our way through the crowd to walk to South Front Street for our appointment at Getz's Clothiers. The solid frontier architecture outside is intact. Inside, customers are being served.
Bill.
John Spigarelli is vice president of marketing for Getz. He's a Upper native and has been working here for 10 years.
The original store was founded in this local area in the late 1800s. The current owner's great-great-grandfather started this operation, and he brought a very needed source of workwear and work clothing to the area's laborers. You know, the timber industry, the mining industry. He had a horse and cart, and he went all over the place and provided these products to people, and it's a great story.
What do people buy?
Summertime is very different than wintertime. You know, our summertime months, a lot of tourism, a lot of people enjoying the outdoors. So it's your standard mix of shorts and tees. But the wintertime is where we really excel because, thankfully, Mother Nature helps us out greatly here. But our outerwear business is unbelievable.
The shelves in the hangars are full of new winter stuff, very fashionable flannel shirts, fleece parkas, jeans, and overalls. Soft gloves and hats compete for space with scarves and sweaters. The selection is varied in both price and design.
Okay, and there's your change. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Enjoy the rest
You can
day.
Walk down the main street of many cities in the United States, and you won't see any family-owned or independently-owned businesses. And in fact, in so many cities where the commerce has moved out to the highway and the big box stores, it's rare to see a department store in business in a small town. How do you account for Getz's survival?
A lot of loyalty from our local customers. You know, our community is not large, and we're very proud of this. We have a lot of our community members do shop here and shop locally. We really treat people like their family when they come in. You know, they're going to get a, hey, good morning, and be very welcomed in this store, and that has been our real cornerstone of making this business great.
It's one thing to make a business great. It's another to maintain it and sustain it. 20% of Getz's business is walk-in traffic. The other 80% is online.
Now, with the internet, we are right back in the premium workwear marketplace, you know, providing and outfitting blue-collar America, working America, with products that really, you know, it is clothing, but it really is a tool for them. I mean, it's something they need every day to work.
And unconventionally, the warehouse is on the top floor.
The top floor of the downtown Marquette department store is busy with workers packing boxes, mostly from internet orders, and getting them ready to ship around the country. The brain behind Getz's.com is one floor below. It's a rickety old elevator ride down to a small warren of rooms with computers. Jamie Waters and Carrie Roy sit in their cubicles answering shoppers' questions and processing internet orders.
It just wouldn't have all the items from our website.
Getz Clothiers went online in 1997. At first, they sold to neighboring counties and states. Soon, orders were coming in from both coasts. The thick blue internet cables wind like renegade vines up the wall next to John Spigarelli's desk, evidence of the scope of Getz's web business.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
So essentially, the internet has pretty much saved Getz's department store.
Yes. Getz's department store would be around without the internet, but it wouldn't be as vast as it is now.
Have you seen the effects of the recession on your business?
In some cases, particularly anything that we had done that was fringe, very high-end product. But we've also seen a growth in the business of products that are of value, products that are durable, products that stand for quality.
It's rare that I get to talk to a department store manager wearing flip-flops and shorts.
Yes, it's casual Saturday, but it's a testament to, you know, our type of business. We're a very laid-back, friendly organization, and it's a great atmosphere to work in.
And a laid-back, friendly place to shop.
Beautiful weather.
Prime time in the UP.
Mm-hmm.
There you are, sir. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Economic developments at the G20 were overshadowed by the Iran news.
But the G20 leaders, who met last night at dinner and all day today in Pittsburgh, issued a final statement this afternoon outlining a number of economic reforms. NPR's John Itzty now joins us to talk about them. Hi, John.
Hi, Robert.
I guess the big news here is the decision by the G8, the group of eight wealthy nations, to pass the baton to the G20, meaning the responsibility for monitoring the world economy now rests with the bigger group.
That's right. In their communique, the leaders say we designate the G20 to be the premier forum for our international economic cooperation. And even if that might seem a little self-serving, we've got to remember that the G20 represents about 90% of the global economy and about two-thirds of the world's people. Most importantly, I think this officially gives emerging powers like China, India, and Brazil a place at the table where global economic policies are developed. In a written statement announcing the shift this morning, the White House said, "This decision brings to the table the countries needed to build a stronger, more balanced global economy, reform the financial system, and lift the lives of the poorest."
So is it goodbye to the G8?
Well, my understanding is that G8 will continue to function, but it will not be viewed as the top global economic decision-making group, which it has been since the 1970s.
Now, one big issue in the headlines before this G20 summit was a call by French President Sarkozy for caps on bankers' bonuses. What did the leaders decide about that?
Well, they didn't go along with Mr. Sarkozy, and they didn't say an awful lot about it. They did issue some recommendations on compensation, but no real details in their statement. So we'll have to wait to see exactly what they're going to come up with there.
And what about capital requirements, the cushions that banks hold against losses? Any progress in forcing the banks to increase those cushions?
Not a lot of progress there either. The leaders urged banks to set aside more capital, but put off coming up with specific figures until the end of next year. So we got a timetable, but no hard figures.
And there was a big U.S. goal at the G20 summit to get China and other big exporting countries to export less and to consume more at home while the U.S. starts saving more. Any news on that front?
Well, the leaders endorsed what's called a framework for strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. And that framework will be used to make the kinds of changes you just mentioned. The idea is to avoid the big imbalances in the global economy that contributed to the financial crisis. There was concern China might not sign up for this because it feared it might not grow fast enough if it had to depend more on internal growth instead of exports. But China appears to have gone along with the deal. One carrot was the endorsement by the leaders of a plan to give emerging economies, mostly China, a bigger voting share in the International Monetary Fund. The plan calls for rich countries, specifically in Europe, to give up 5% of their voting rights to the emerging nations. So I think we can look at this summit as the one that cemented the role of China, especially, and other emerging nations in global economic policymaking.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Robert.
It's NPR's John Itzty joining us from Pittsburgh. So who's in the G20? Some members are obvious, some not so obvious. You can test your G20 IQ at The Two-Way, NPR's news blog. Go to npr.org/two-way.